This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas, powered by U Mobile.
Good morning, this is The Breakfast Grill. I'm Keith Kam. When Pakatan Harapan won Malaysia's 14th general election in May 2018, the country saw a new government ushered in, one with a very different view, a vastly different way of working than what most of us, and certainly the business community, had been used to for over 60 years. Malaysia Baru was what this period had been called, along with new hope felt by citizens at that time. With us this morning is Yeo Bee-in, the former Minister of Energy, Science, Technology, the Environment and Climate Change, and she has written a new book, The Unfinished Business, chronicling her time as a minister for 20-odd months under this Malaysia Baru Pakatan Harapan government. Good morning, Bee-in.
Good morning.
All right, let's start with your time as MESTEC minister. Yeah. You were minister in charge of energy, science, technology, the environment and climate change at a time when awareness of the environment was at its height and is still growing today. MESTEC was a newly created ministry and you were new to the intricacies of running a government portfolio in a civil service that has been so used to doing things a certain way. What was your biggest challenge in trying to remold the mindset of the people you work with?
Yeah, I think the biggest challenge for me is that the lack of experience as a minister, and that all my friends also lack of experience. So those were our problem, where we, you know, we take about two to three months just to get used to, you know, how the government machinery work. But of course, for me also, because I have many portfolios, and that to be able to know what is the focus of each portfolio, otherwise you'll be busy for nothing. To know the focus of each portfolio also takes some time.
What was the work culture like among the staff there? I mean, understandably, they've only worked one way.
I think a lot of people have a misconception of what is in the civil service. What I saw in civil service, there are many excellent people there. There are many people who want to do things right. And that one of the culture shock I had, I wrote in the book, is that people, civil service, are so worried about the ego, trying to go to show face in a lot of functions, you know. They want to, you know, the first time when I had my international trip, I was actually asked whether there is a need for anybody to send me off in the airport, you know. So I think it is the politicians that make, that bind the and limit the productivity of the civil service. And I see a lot of good, excellent people. If we can actually do a reform in the civil service structure and how we promote people, how we actually train them, I think our civil service can be excellent as many other developed countries.
All these anecdotes about little Napoleons trying to exert their power within the civil service, did you see any signs of
that? As a minister, you need to know your staff. Mm-hmm. So the moment you know your staff, those that you're some sort of called little Napoleon, or those that, you know, want to exert their way, cannot exert their way because you know your staff. But you first of all need to know what is the right thing to do. And there are times that people exert their way because of experience. As a leader, we also should listen to their experiences. Right. Maybe they are right? So there are a balance that we need to take.
Yeah. Okay, before we delve into the unfinished business, which is the title of your book, what do you consider your finished business? You know, what are you most proud of on your report card?
I would say the sending back of the, because we actually experienced an influx of foreign plastic waste to our country, and many other countries, developing countries, were also facing the same thing. I would say that would be the proudest one, that that we actually, as a developing country, actually we voice out for other developing countries that have become a dumping ground for the developed world on their waste.
I would have to agree with you, because for most of us, one memory that we have is you overseeing the repatriation of tons of ostensibly recyclable plastics with brands like Mount Franklin, which is obviously from Australia. But what has happened to that momentum that you put into motion? Because you became internationally known.
So the fortunate part is that, as what I've written in a book, one thing about a leader is that you do not only need to act, you need to institutionalize your action. So after we sent off about 100 of them, we start to write the standard operating procedures for each and every agency that's involved. Actually, this is not only this did not only involve Environment Ministry; it involves many other ministries, the customs, the solid waste management agency, etc. So what we do is that we write a standard of SOP for everyone, and that we publish it and everyone knows it. So after I left, the things continue because people know how to do it, and there is a SOPs to follow. And in the civil service, people transfer from one agency to another. We always face a problem with the lack of institutional memory. So with you institutionalize the procedures, whoever that replaced the jawatan, the position, they will know what to do according to what is written already.
And there's successor as well.
Yes, and the successor. So now I'm very proud that every parliament session I ask, so they are sending back. But the sending countries don't send to Malaysia anymore because they know that we are sending it back. So they are getting fewer and fewer containers that we send back. But we continue to send back even after our time.
I do remember covering one of your events and you did highlight about writing standard operating procedures so that subsequent generations of staff can follow. Yeah. What other SOPs have you come up with for ministry?
So the other part is that in Environment Ministry, there is one, it's on the solid waste, on the plastic waste. The other also are what we call a scheduled waste or electronic e-waste. So we also put the procedures on it, and then also the heavy metals import, and some you cannot. So we put the standards. And then we put even the pictures. So you cannot be like one officer's think that this passed, the other officer's think it doesn't pass. It happens now also, you know, the standards that is written by the ministers or the guidelines by the ministry are not clear. So we make it very, very clear in terms of that. And also open burning. So we also have strikes. Procedures on open burning. So what you should do, which each agency, what you should do, There are many, many procedures that I write. The only thing that that is regret is that I was not able to put the amendment to the Environmental Quality Act on time, and that I have not been because I did not know. I only had 20 months. So 2020, I was supposed to table Transboundary Haze Act. I was supposed to table amendment to the Environment Quality Act. I am also supposed to table Energy Efficiency and Conservation Act. All these acts were supposed to be tabled in 2020, and this year we are supposed to table Climate Change Act. So all of this it's the unfinished
Basically your unfinished business.
Yeah, I just do not know that, you know, that
will
the
they
time
ever
is
see,
so short.
Will they ever see the light of day eventually, you think?
I think so. I have asked in the parliament, except with the Transboundary Haze Act that the government has decided not to continue. The Energy Efficiency and Conservation Act will be tabled according to parliament end of this year. And unfortunately, the Climate Change Act, I do not know why, they only will table it in 2025. And then the amendment to the Environment Quality Act will table next year.
Coming back to the transboundary haze problem, I mean, it's something that happens regularly and everybody knows why.
Yeah.
So the question is, why does it still keep happening?
Yeah, the detail of why it happens, mainly is because of the smallholders in Indonesia that is still burning their forests so that they can sell the land, because the land titles in Indonesia is... their land management is a bit messy. So what they do is that if I can burn this land, I can sell this land to some other people. So the Transboundary Haze Act was supposed to, one, to make sure that our companies don't misbehave in by submitting their satellite data. And the second is that you must declare land that you buy in Indonesia. So we are not saying that, because, you know, big companies will always tell you, I don't slash and burn. But they still buy the land that is slashed and burned by the smallholders.
Right.
So if we can actually make it mandatory for them to declare that what land do you buy and how was it cleared before you buy. But you cannot punish them. You know, if they buy a slash and burn land, you cannot punish them. But when they declare it, you know, there is an impact in the sunlight, right? So right. there is a transparency. People, then why you buy a slash and burn land? So the Transboundary Haze Act, a lot of people say it is it will be ineffective, blah, 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 blah. But there are some things that it can be done.
I'm also curious, when you were in cabinet, Theresa Koch was in charge you know, the palm oil industry. Yeah. What sort of conversations did you guys have regarding this? Were there a lot of clashes?
So I don't know whether the people remember, there was once I was not an open fight. I just wrote in my Facebook, you know, because all the haze was coming from Indonesia, and then the Indonesian environment minister was saying that it's not from Indonesia, da-da-da. So I put up a map from SMC, and they say, you know, you just check the map, right? And there is a hot spot, and there is a wind direction, and you can see. I just say the fact speaks for itself, and the whole tension escalate. Right. So Theresa received a lot of help call from the palm oil industry to ask me to tone down. So that was when I said, okay, I need to ask the Prime Minister for advice, since Tun was very experienced in this. So he told me I would not be able to solve problem there and then. He said, there is no point for me to have a big fight. So he even asked me, do you want a war? I say, why not we boycott? He said, what about people boycott you back? So eventually I decided, okay, we should calm down. But then in the book itself, I actually wrote the three steps that we should actually do moving forward long term. We cannot be looking. I remember 1997 when I was small. The haze is a big problem. It's a huge haze. And then 20 years later, we talk about the same thing. So I really do not want 20 years from now, we still talk about the same thing by not doing anything. So so that is why in the book, I actually laid out the long-term plan. One of it is the Transboundary Haze Act on how Malaysia can take a more proactive role in dealing with the problem. Of course, you would definitely hope that Indonesia will also act on it. And I'm very optimistic of that they will act on it one day.
Bean, if you allow me to be just a little bit personal, your husband is the executive vice chairman of IOI Properties Group, a company typically linked with oil palm plantations. Yeah. Yes, I know they are RSPO, MSPO certified, but people basically don't really care. Yeah. Oil palm is oil palm. Yeah. How do conversations on haze go in your home? Yeah.
So my husband is not working in oil. Not directly in, and he's not executive director in any in the oil palm business. Actually, we did not mention anything during the haze season because they know I was doing my job. So I told my husband, if it is found that you know IOI really do something wrong, I have to take action, or I have to speak up against the big companies lah. So I think the position was very clear. They don't dare to intervene my work.
With us at BFM on the Breakfast Grill this morning is the former Minister of Energy, Science, Technology, the Environment and Climate Change, Yeo Bee-in. Stay with us because in a little while, we will find out why there is still hope for Malaysia. This is BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill. Brought to you by U Mobile.
Welcome back to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Keith Kam, and with me this morning is Yeo Bee-in, the former Minister of Energy, Science, Technology, the Environment and Climate Change. She is also the current Member of Parliament for the Bakri constituency in Bakri, Johor. I still want to discuss a little bit about your experience in the ministry. I mean, everyone knows one thing famous about the way government runs is this term called direct nego, referring to contracts that are negotiated directly with the government as opposed to open tenders. How hard was that to implement for your ministry, open tenders?
The most difficult part was the IPP, the independent power producer, as an energy minister. IPP is a business that if you can actually get it by direct negotiation at a certain rate, a favorable rate and term, then you can actually appoint EPC, engineering, procurement and commissioning partner like GE Electric, General Electric or Siemens to run the business, to commission the whole plant for you and even to operate for you. You can then take the difference, you know, what you pay to your EPC and what you get from the contract. So it's actually a cash cow, very easy.
Basically very lucrative.
Very, very easy for if you can get it direct. So what happened was that after the 2018 election, when I go to office, the first thing that comes to my table is the Direct Nego award. There were so many of them, so it was on my table. Many of them, actually, throughout the 20 months, we cancelled about 20, about six of them, and then about six of the IPPs that are able to actually save people about 12 billion ringgit of their future hike in electricity bill.
It's taxpayers' money also.
It's taxpayers' money. And what people do not understand is this, yeah. Actually, if people say, okay, why not we build another power plant? It's okay to have reserve. But reserve, there is an optimal reserve that you can. So Malaysia, Peninsula Malaysia, our optimal reserve is 25%. Mm-hmm. So anything more than that, you are paying extra for nothing. So if we build all the plants that is approved by the direct negotiation a year before GE14, we will hit 50% reserve margin. And 30% of your electricity bill comes from capacity payment. That is the reserve margin. So if we can actually optimize it, so we can then save people's money. I mean, what is the tariff that you business as usual tariff compared to if you don't cancel how much is the tariff? It doesn't mean that we lower the tariff. It means that even when it increased, because let's say, for example, there is a fuel price increase, because 70% it still depends on fuel price, but at least the capacity payments is optimized. So you pay the minimum you could pay at that circumstances.
In your book, you talked about intense lobbying, which we can imagine, but could you just paint us a picture on what do you mean by intense lobbying? How aggressive were they?
So I have to control what I can say.
Right.
So we experience not one but two, quite many of them that come and say, you know, I am the I'm related to whoever that come, and then they do not only tell you that to ask you for a direct award of IPP, they demand for it, and that if you don't give, and then they will write complaint to many people and say, this minister is not business friendly, because if we get this IPP award, we are going to be able to bring in FDI, blah, 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 blah. But the thing is, if we need electricity, if I award the IPP to somebody, that person will be able to give the best possible electricity tariff, as well as have the investment that is needed, because there is a award from the government. So I actually experienced that in the most intensely in large-scale solar contract, because we were also having an RE target of 25%, excluding large hydro, hitting by 2025. So that time we were trying to open a tender for 500 megawatt of large-scale solar project. That is when all the lobby come. So no, they don't want to participate in the open tender. We already have the open tender. I said, you can go participate in the open tender. And they don't want.
Well, at least there was no bribery involved, right?
No, they know that they cannot bribe me. So they don't come and bribe. To be frank, in the 20 months, I have not received any offer of bribe.
Veen, I want to switch gears and talk about politics, because everyone remembers where they were on May 10th, 2018, after midnight. Regardless of which coalition they voted for, you were either euphoric or you were heartbroken. Just over 20 months since then, at the dawn of the pandemic, Malaysia was thrust back into the old ways of doing things. What lessons do you think Malaysians gained most from watching the antics of Azmin Ali and his gang, which subsequently saw a new unelected government sweep to power?
I think as a Malaysian, I learned that change is a gradual process. Then we realised that, you know, even myself on the 10th of May. And
G14 was too G14. Drastic a change, you thought?
No, as in G14, we expect change to come very fast.
Right.
We expect things to happen like yesterday. We expect, like, if we elect a new government, things are going to change the next day. And then we get into government and we realise that, you know, it's going to take time to change. And so I think for me, through this process, I learned that we must be patient in bringing change. Sometimes you fall, you know, sometimes like things like Sheraton Move happen. People betray you, you know, people that seems to work with you, struggle with you, suddenly just turn. And they just spoke things that, you know, you would never imagine them doing. But then you realise that that things are still progressing forward. Especially recent open up, recent development in politics. We just passed the anti-hopping law, and that in the parliament and all the MOU, I actually see a new light in politics in Malaysia. One is that we must believe that the single party hegemony must go. The time of single party, because absolute power brings absolute corruption. So we do not want to go back to those single party time. But now is the time when we decide where we go forward. And it's an exciting time. So I give you an example of the tobacco bill. Tobacco bill, if it is a big majority UMNO, Barisan Nasional thing, the tobacco bill with so many of these wide-ranging power that give to the power enforcement officer, it will still be passed last week. Because the numbers were slim, because people start to, when politics is no longer an issue, because we know that there's MOU, so we don't think about okay, who is jumping all this, and then we know there's anti-hopping law coming, so we never think of jumping, we focus on policies. So my hope for the future is this, is that after GE15, it may still be no big majority for any single party, but we form a coalition that is based on policy. We agree on policies. And these policies also should be agreed upon by the whatever new policies that come by this government should also be agreed by the other side, the opposition. So at least for three areas. One, economy. Second, environment. And then education. Let's not make this, if we change the government, we change the policy. We change the government, change the policy. So whenever we have new policy, this new government must then get an agreement of the opposition. So that means another 5 years, whoever become a government, people in the business that know. I'm okay.
There's continuity.
There is continuity. There is certainty for investors to invest in Malaysia. I think it is very, very important right now to do this, to strengthen the parliament. Now that we have anti-hopping law out, we have Parliament Service Act. If we can strengthen parliament, and then to be able to have this bipartisan agreement on new policy for economic, education and environment, then we can do a lot as a country. And that we do not need to go back to the single party hegemony for so-called stability, because there is no stability except with like absolute corruption.
Do you think that the anti-hopping law itself is a silver bullet that will solve all these problems? And that people will finally feel, you know, my vote is actually worth it?
Oh, okay. That I think for now, yes, it is important. But it is not a silver bullet to make our country democratic again. I think there are many, many things that we need, there are many reforms that we need to do to bring a more accountable government. I'm not saying that, you know, Pakatan Harapan is very good, you know. And we don't need to be government all the time. Mm-hmm. But we need to be an alternative to people. Sometimes we become government. Sometimes Barisan Nasional become government. Sometimes some other people become government. Sometimes there is an awkward coalition become government. But what we want to bring it to people on a new future is this. Whoever you vote for, you will not be penalized by voting for an opposition. There is an equal allocation for all constituency.
The spirit of democracy. Yeah.
And then whoever you vote for, so you can be assured that they don't jump. And the other part is that the policies that they advocate, even their opposition may be able to be taken by the government because there is a strengthened parliament. That is the future I want to see for Malaysia. So right now, Malaysians must decide.
Speaking of the future, what are your plans for GE15? Do you see yourself still contesting?
I think, you know, you see politics in Malaysia. One day is very long. So, so not too many. You know, there are times that people ask me whether next year you want to do this or not. You know, we one day at a time. For me, most important right now is to do the best I can right now in the task that is in my hand. So,
Do we read anything into the fact that you didn't make it into the DAP CEC?
It doesn't really matter. That is not my consideration of what my future holds. The only thing I can guarantee is that I will not retire from working.
What do you see yourself doing in, say, 10 years' time?
I love nation building. I think I'm very passionate about building this country to be a better country. There are many platforms to do the same thing, and that different people may have different season in their life. They may choose different things. I'm not saying that politics is not the way, but I'm just saying that there are many things that we can do in nation building. So what I can foresee myself 10 years' time is I continue to use my energy and time to contribute to nation building. Yeah.
Yeo Bee-in, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
I have been speaking to Yeo Bee-in, former Minister of Energy, Science, Technology, the Environment and Climate Change, the current Member of Parliament for Bakri, author, engineer, wife and mother. This has been The Breakfast Grill. I'm Keith Kam for BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U Mobile, where unlimited potential begins.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.